It's 19 hours 30 UTC on Tuesday, December 5th, and this is Zimbabwe Today.
Yeah, they're very supporting, and most of them too are planning to move back home.
Hashid Bwanzura, a young Zimbabwean planning to move back home after years in the United States. We'll have more of that story coming up. Good evening, I'm Mike Hawley.
And I'm Chidonjere on VOA Zimbabwe Today.
Despite the change of political leadership in Zimbabwe recently, authorities in Harare still want informal vendors to leave the streets and go to designated vending sites. Reporter Kudzai Zhivanashe has the report.
In Zimbabwe, recently there were wild cheers and a sense of relief after the military took over control and eventually elbowed President Robert Mugabe out after 37 years. Informal vendors who have been resisting a long campaign in Harare to force them off the streets started returning to their old locations. Authorities, however, have not ended the restrictions on vendors. They still want them relocated to centralized areas. Michael Chideme is the city council spokesperson.
We just assumed everybody was in a celebratory mood. So they came back onto the streets because they were probably celebrating, and they also took advantage of the situation. But now that we have gone back to normalcy, we should also go back to normalcy on all activities that happen in the city.
Vendors are not happy with the position. Samuel Wadzai is with the Vendors Initiative for Social and Economic Transformation.
We would like to register our displeasure at the manner in which the Harare City Council, working in cahoots with the Zimbabwe Republic Police and the military. We don't understand why such a move has been taken. We expected the new government to engage with us as vendors so that we find a way forward that is inclusive.
Gift Ostalos is with Tajamuka, a social movement that staged multiple protests against Mugabe's administration.
It is very clear and said that the new government has fit very well in the smelly shoes of Robert Mugabe. One of the arising contradictions between Mugabe and the ordinary citizen was his continual and perennial thump on vendors in an economy that is highly informalized.
Ostalos and Wadzai say the city's restrictions are a direct attack on the vendors' livelihoods. The municipal police, the national police, and the military are handling the vendor clearing operation. They are concerned about the military's role in a civilian issue. Chideme explains the military's involvement.
We have always worked with the law enforcement agency. We have always worked with them, and we will always work with them. The reason being, we don't have arresting powers. And we are also very thin on the ground, so we need their support.
The city council has designated vending sites, but residents, associations and street vendors say those sites are away from the people and are not big enough. Wadzai says they have written letters to city officials asking for help in finding better solutions. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zhinawashe from Harare.
Tabang Nare is the founder of the Bulawayo Vendors and Traders Association, now a development consultant in the United States. He spoke with me about the importance of the informal vendors to Zimbabwe's economy.
The vendors in Zimbabwe, they are varying statistics. You'll note that the statistics agency in Zimbabwe, Zimstat, states that unemployment is well over 80%, close to 90% in Zimbabwe. And they then say from that 90%, at least 70% of people are formally employed. They are vendors, they are informal traders, they are informal workers. So there are varying statistics that people give. But I would say over 3 million people are working in different cities across Zimbabwe, from Bulawayo, Harare, Chukwuza, you know, all the big centers, including the smaller towns and cross points, they are working as vendors and informal traders.
How important are vendors to Zimbabwe's economy right now?
Because the formal economy, if you look at formal agriculture through the processes that took place, that formal agriculture, which used to employ over 350,000 agricultural workers, basically collapsed. So you have maybe 30,000 people who are working as tobacco farmers, you know, in the smallholder farming communities that are there. So vending has become the way of survival for most people. It has informalized business, basically. So the majority of people, instead of continuously going to the big chain stores like OK, TM, they find themselves buying their daily supplies closer home at the local vendor.
So since vendors are play such a big part in Zimbabwe, why do you think the government wants them off the streets?
I think specifically, you note that we have a new government led by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, and I think he wants to clearly demonstrate that he has got a grip on things. And getting vendors off the streets is one way to show that we are here to instill order and discipline. I think what we know is that local authorities, including the city of Harare, the city of Bulawayo, have been struggling to contain the numbers of vendors that are there in the city. I think this has been unprecedented, unplanned for. And instead of engaging with the issue in a very pragmatic and inclusive way, the idea has been to close off the eyes and then to say, as long as we remove the vendors off the streets, we'll have solved the problem.
The Tolocho Road disaster this past weekend in Zimbabwe has left many on social media shocked. At least 22 health workers died when the truck they were in rolled over. On the internet, a big question is about their vehicle. Ranga Mataire says, "Disaster, something must seriously be done, and someone has to answer. This was an accident waiting to happen. Loading people into a truck like termites is not what you would expect from an institution working for the prevention of death through malaria."
Keith Quio says, "That's why we need a new Zimbabwe as soon as possible. Why workers are transported in trucks instead of buses?"
Taka Mubako says, "The issue goes beyond possible negligence on the part of an employer. Maybe think the issue goes to our own self-worth as individuals. Personally, we have become so used to being cattle/commodities that we don't react or object when we are packed like sardines into vehicles that speed and we are too afraid to voice our concerns."
Jenny Stewart says, "What a tragic waste of precious people's lives. That could have been avoided. Sincere condolences."
As political change comes to Zimbabwe last month, hundreds of thousands of Zimbabweans living overseas suddenly began thinking of going home. Kudakwashe Gwanzura is one of them. The 34-year-old cybersecurity consultant living near Washington, D.C., came to the United States just out of secondary school. But now he's looking for a way to use what he has learned in the U.S. to help his country. He spoke with me today.
"I think it's necessary that I return home. There's so much I need to offload the lessons that I've learned here back home. I think it helps with growing the economy too."
And what about any of your Zimbabwean friends or family? What are they saying?
Very supportive. They're very supportive of that decision, considering what transpired in November. So, yeah, they're very supporting. And most of them, too, are planning to move back home.
So with the new cabinet, what do you think some of their key priorities should be?
The economy, jobs, and education.
And based on, you know, you said you went to school in the States, what do you think you can kind of give to Zimbabwe? Like, what, like, lessons?
Lessons. Definitely the lessons of the Western world, kind of projecting a lot more information from a worldly perspective, and then help tailor to our traditions, our culture back home, so that the world really understands Zimbabwe for what it is and not from other people's perspectives that are not from Zimbabwe.
In terms of the vice president, who would you like, or who would you hope the president would pick for vice president?
or vice president, I think I leave that for the people that are back home. They understand the person they want, and I think it's important I point out that because for a long time, a lot of people didn't have the capability to speak out to choose who they wanted. So I think the people back home have a major say. And I think from their, you know, perspective, being on the ground, I will accept and respect whoever they choose.
With this new administration, do you have any concerns?
I don't think it's quite lean as we had assumed it would be. However, again, it is a lesson to learn. It's an ongoing lesson. And we see the guys up top taking out people that are not qualified, that will not benefit them in the cabinet. And, for instance, we look at reports about the Minister of Education being removed. I think that's a great start. But I think it can become more leaner than it is now.
That was Zimbabwean expatriate Gudakwashe Gwanzira speaking with me about his hopes for the country.
You're listening to Zimbabwe Today, live from Voice of America's Studio 22. I'm Mike Horvett in Washington. At 41 minutes past the hour, we continue with news from Zimbabwe's momentous political change.
A recent report says freedom on the internet has declined for the seventh straight year, with the rise in government manipulation of internet access and social media. VOA senior analyst Jeffrey Young has a look at how the internet in sub-Saharan Africa is faring.
The NGO Freedom House recently issued its annual report, Freedom on the Net 2017, stating that overall the web continues to suffer ever greater restrictions. The internet situation in sub-Saharan Africa is explained by Freedom House program manager Mai Trong.
The countries that declined in internet freedom in sub-Saharan Africa included Ethiopia, Malawi, Rwanda, and Zambia. Elections and protests were the main reasons behind internet freedom restrictions in those countries in the past year.
But on the brighter side, the report says Uganda showed notable improvements. Governments in the region are moving to control social media on the web. The report says Ethiopia was a significant offender in that regard.
Ethiopia was the country that placed the greatest restrictions on access to social media through blocking of apps such as Facebook, WhatsApp, Twitter at times, and Instagram. And again, it was throughout 2016 and 2017 as the government tried to dispel anti-government protests during a state of emergency.
But some countries went beyond blocking social media to turning off the internet entirely. Freedom House says this took place in Ethiopia, the Gambia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The journalist advocacy NGO Africa Freedom of Expression Exchange, or AFEX, says that in January 2017, Cameroon also shut down the internet for 94 days in its English-speaking areas following political protests. AFEX official Felicia Antonio told VOA via Skype from Accra, Ghana, that government shutdowns of the internet only amplify problems.
And we believe that internet shutdowns do not solve or calm down situations during protests. It only escalates.
The Freedom House report also says that a number of sub-Saharan African countries are using legislation to restrict the internet, as Ms. Trong details.
Many countries in the region are passing new laws that restrict certain types of speech online that include incitement or hate speech, and even explicitly criticism of the authorities. And those laws are typically broadly worded and can be used to crack down against legitimate speech, political speech or social speech.
The internet's reach and impact in sub-Saharan Africa grows daily. Analysts say because of that, governments in the region must accept the reality of its presence instead of treating it as a threat. But for now, the situation oftentimes remains contentious. Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
In his office, in his 2 years in office, President John Magufuli has brought many changes to Tanzania, though critics say not all of them are for the better. Mohamed Yusuf and Khalid Abubakar report from Dar es Salaam.
President John Magufuli has been criticized for being arrogant and autocratic when dealing with opponents, either perceived or real. In his speech, the Tanzanian president warned those who looted public money, they shall be careful, I can decide in 2 or 3 days to change the currency. During 5 years as Minister of Works, Magufuli earned his nickname, the Bulldozer, for his habit of pushing aside any obstacle in order to get what he wants. As president, he often takes a similar approach. In April, he fired more than 9,000 government workers over fake education certificates. His no-nonsense ways can get results. For instance, the government is building a railway, roads, and pipelines to connect the country to neighboring Uganda. But his methods leave activists and the opposition concerned. Zito Kabu is an opposition lawmaker. He says Magufuli's approach is short-sighted.
We have a president who hates multi-party democracy. He might be developmental. He would like to see the country going forward. But he hates democracy. And without democracy, development is not sustainable. Because without democracy, the institutions of accountability, the inclusive institutions that will enable the country to move forward, will not develop.
Human rights groups have accused the government of using repressive legislation to muzzle the media and civil society. The laws have been used against Maxine Melo, the co-founder of Jamii Forums, a whistleblowing website. The website was dedicated to exposing corruption in Tanzania, but Melo was accused of obstructing an investigation and failing to register the website with the state. Melo says the authorities need to stop seeing critics as enemies.
You need the media to fight corruption. Whatever kind of fight he's trying to fight, the anti-corruption kind of drive, it's the same things that we as the media revealed. We are the ones who managed to make sure that these things are getting to the parliament.
Political analyst Azafiri Luwaitama says the ruling CCM party is afraid of losing power after 56 years of rule.
The reality on the ground from 2010, 2015, you know, was that, you know, this party had lost its legitimate appeal to being inclusive. So they organized an election, they made sure that they won, but there is uncertainty. So they are trying to crush the opposition, so that they can then sort things out within themselves.
In the 2015 election, President Magufuli received 58% of the vote, a big drop from previous elections, in which 80% of Tanzanians voted for the CCM party. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
The International Humanitarian Aid Agency, Oxfam, declares a migrant emergency on the borders of Italy and France and urges authorities to protect migrants' rights. Oxfam says every day they are meeting children who are being sent back from France, many on foot and with nowhere to go. In other developments, Italian Interior Minister Marco Minniti says that Islamist foreign fighters could be among the waves of migrants trying to reach Europe via the Mediterranean. My colleague Kim Lewis spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome about the latest migrant developments.
Oxfam, the aid agency, has declared a migrant emergency on the border of Italy and France and urged authorities to do more to protect migrant rights. And this came with statistics that were published in Italian media showing that since the beginning of the year, 45,000 migrants have reportedly been sent back to Ventimiglia, the town on the border of Italy and France, by the French authorities. And that's much higher than last year, which was around 37,000. Right now, Oxfam is very concerned, saying that there are around 700 migrants living in this tiny border town of Ventimiglia. 500 are in the Red Cross center that takes care of them, and another 200 are believed to be sleeping on the streets and along the river inside that town.
So what is happening to them once that they are stopped from crossing the border?
Well, it seems that they've been stopped by police in towns like Monton and Cannes, just over the border from Italy. The officials from Oxfam say that children, unaccompanied children, are also among those migrants who have been stopped and who are staying in Ventimiglia. And there are concerns that some of them are saying that they have been stopped by police, they've been handcuffed, they've been mistreated, they've been beaten, and then sent back on foot most of the time across the border. That's quite a difficult situation for some of these migrants who obviously don't want to stay in Italy and want to move through Italy to other parts of Europe. I was just on a train the other day in Italy, and two African migrants were having a conversation next to me about whether they should move through the other European countries and make their way to Sweden, where they feel that there are better services for migrants.
Also, I understand that Italy's interior minister has said that Islamist foreign fighters could be among the waves of migrants trying to reach Europe through the Mediterranean.
He was telling the European Parliament that the question of border security is absolutely critical. Having said that, Italy is monitoring migrants very closely, and this year we've seen around 100 sent away from Italy who have alleged links with jihadist groups or were of concern to the Italian government.
And the IOM is looking to, I guess they're in the process of stepping up repatriation. Can you tell us more about this program?
The International Organization for Migration has been scaling up its voluntary humanitarian return program in Libya. Now, more than 14,000 migrants have been sent back to their home countries so far this year. Now there are plans to take a further 15,000 migrants home from detention in Libya. And that's being conducted with the support of the African Union. There was a statement today from the Vice President of the Commission of the African Union, Kwesi Kwarte, saying that they are fully supportive and hoping to see these migrants sent back to their home countries and removed from situations where they're being tortured, mistreated, often starved and beaten inside Libya. We're also seeing figures from the IOM saying that in recent weeks, Libya has seen a drastic reduction in the number of migrants held in detention centres from the usual range of 5,000 to 6,000 as migrants have been transferred from unofficial detention centres in Sabratha.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Rome.
The International Olympic Committee has banned Russia from competing in the 2018 Pyeongchang Olympics in South Korea. The move is punishment for what investigators say was a widespread doping program for Russian Olympic athletes at the 2014 Sochi Games. Investigators charge that Russian sports officials were complicit in the doping. Under the ruling, Russian officials may not attend the games. The Russian flag will not be flown, and the record books for the games will show that the traditional sports powerhouses won no medals. Individual Russian athletes who won certain requirements will be allowed to compete, but they will wear few neutral uniforms.
Thousands of people have been fleeing from villages in the English-speaking region of Cameroon less than a week after President Biya declared war against separatist groups. Those fleeing complain of rapes, killings, and harassment by troops, but the military says they are out to defend the population. Moki Edwin Kinzenka reports from the English-speaking town of Biu.
The number of people traveling along the Kumbamamfe Road in the English-speaking southwest region of Cameroon has drastically dropped. It is along this road that goods from Nigeria are brought into Cameroon and vice versa. 32-year-old merchant Takam Etel says she and her peers suspended business trips between Cameroon and Nigeria after President Biya declared war on separatist groups.
Well, the number of checkpoints are just unbearable. Since the president announced that he was fighting against terrorists, it's as if he removed his hungry lions, called the military, from their den. Those who want to be killed can travel As for me, I still have my life ahead, so I will not move.
Violence in the towns of Mamfe and Yumojok last week claimed the lives of at least 6 soldiers and a police officer. Yumojok is also the hometown of Julius Ayuk Tabe, the man who says he is the first president of Ambazonia, the state the separatists say they have created. The government of Cameroon says many fighters were being trained there and across the border in Nigeria. Residents say most youths have escaped to the bushes to flee the heavy presence of the military. Nyeke George Likiye, an independent analyst in southwestern Cameroon, says he has written to the national government to complain about the troops.
They are doing their job in excess proportions. There are some arrests, some, you know, unreasonable arrests that have been done. People have been tortured. People have been beaten. This is not correct.
General Milingi Noma, one of Cameroon's highest-ranking military officers, denies the southwest has been militarized or that soldiers are committing atrocities. The general says he is aware of alleged excesses, but insists the military is there to protect the population.
We know that if we want to overcome this crisis, we have to make sure the population is involved. How can you go and embrace and arrest people whom you want to take information from? If they cannot give us the correct information, if they cannot tell us the truth of what is happening in the field, you see that the population will then turn and follow those secessionists.
Schools have been closed in most of the English-speaking Northwest and Southwest since November of last year, when lawyers and teachers called for a strike to stop what they believed was the overbearing use of the French language. Violence erupted when separatists joined in and started asking for complete independence. President Biya has said he is not open to any negotiation on the form of the state and that Cameroon is one country. Moki, Edwin Kintika for VOA News, Boya, Cameroon.
Song by Knox there, man. That is it for us this evening on VOA Zimbabwe Today. I'm Mike Hove.
And I'm Chidongere. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shona and Ndebele broadcast can be heard at 6 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock. Facebook at Studio 7, VOA Ndebele and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com.